Esther 2, beginning of verse 21. In those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door, were wroth and sought to lay hand on the king Ahasuerus. And the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it unto Esther the queen, and Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. And when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Therefore, they were both hanged on a tree. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. With the conclusion of verse 20, we are really poised at the end of one cycle of providence in the book of Esther. But as we see again and again, the cycle of providence is never ending, as it were, especially that special providence that is being exercised by God toward his church. But before we look at the events which initiate the next cycle of providence in this book, we should consider the mercy and the kindness and the benefits of adoption. We were told that Esther had been left an orphan almost certainly from birth. And yet, she'd found in Mordecai a friend that sticketh closer than a brother. She'd found in Mordecai a parental guardian, one who treated her not simply as his own child, but much more than that. He took a very deep interest in instructing her and raising her in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. You know, there are many parents that are very concerned with the temporal needs of their children. It would be highly unnatural for a child to be rejected by its parents with respect to those temporal needs. You know, it's natural for parents to be concerned about those kinds of things. But that's not even the better part. Mordecai was concerned to see that she had instilled in her a sense of true religion. Mordecai was her benefactor in many ways, providing all things necessary. Not merely the things necessary for her temporal well-being, but especially those things necessary for her eternal well-being. Mordecai was a protector who oversaw not merely her comfort in this life, but her safety in the life to come. And he did so in a world that very often is, well, less than kind to orphans. Under his roof then, under the protection of his wing, she lived until such time as she was selected to be taken to the king's house. And we've seen that even as she was being prepared in that first house of women, the house of the virgins, we see that even then, Mordecai was very solicitous over her care. He was very much exercised about her state. He paced back and forth. Told he went to and fro in front of the house, walking, trying to catch hold of any information. And in all probability, trying to convey any words of counsel or comfort that he could while she was there. Now, what we see in this whole arrangement then is that there are many advantages which fell to Esther by reason of this adoption. The fact is that by reason of this adoption, she's taken up so that she, through her childhood and her youth, her adolescence, she needed for nothing. Unlike some orphans, she was not left to a hapless existence, wandering and wondering where she might find food or clothing or even shelter. But more importantly, as I said, she has a home in Mordecai. She finds a home that includes an education. And this education, as we can see from its result, it was an education very much well suited to her status, first of all, as a woman. He trained her to be a godly woman. But his training was thorough. And so she was also, as it turns out, she was also prepared to meet her destiny as a queen. Now, to this, very importantly, to this general training, was added that training whereby she was schooled in the obedience and piety of true religion. Mordecai cared for her both body and soul. Mordecai's concern for her didn't stop with temporal need. Mordecai understood that without the presence of true religion, there could be no real education, but only soulless indoctrination, which is a great problem with our education system today. Without faith, Esther couldn't be trained up in principles, but only brainwashed into a mindless conformity. So doubtless then, Mordecai catechized her in the first principles of the faith. And by reason of that, she grew in knowledge and understanding. And he led her by steps into more advanced doctrine and practice as she moved on, as she was sanctified. Or to use the apostles' words, he moved her from milk to meat. He was her father in all things, natural things and spiritual things. And in this way, he exerted tremendous influence. In this way, Mordecai provided careful protection for her from many of the temptations which would have pressed upon her as an orphan and as a beautiful young woman cut loose in a society of heathens. From this place, then, in the process of time, she's elevated by divine providence to occupy that station in which her life would find its proper purpose. She'd find her life work. She would find out in what it would consist, and all because of this adoption. Now, this adoption, if we reflect upon it, also brought a number of blessings to Mordecai. Certainly through this adoption, God set, as it were, the solitary in a family. We have no record of Mordecai having any other immediate family. Through this adoption, Mordecai would come to know the peculiar pleasure of having such a poised, intelligent, and beautiful daughter. He'd be privileged to bask in that loving devotion that only a daughter can give when she expresses her filial affection. And the gratitude for this would be increased in this daughter by the knowledge that as an orphan, she was actually a child he had sought out. As she grew, Mordecai would be in a position to take great delight in all of the careful attention that she gave to all of his careful admonitions. And all of this, as we're going to see, all of this is going to be crowned with the knowledge that Esther's success in life will result in saving both him and all of the people of God. And so that constitutes a great blessing to Mordecai. Now, as we reflect upon then the many kindnesses, the various mercies and benefits that we see in the adoption of Esther, fact is that we should pause to consider these very things as they pertain to us if we believe. You know, we are by nature cast out. We're orphans. We're born aliens, alienated not only from God, but from one another and even from ourselves. And so God the Father has shed forth his great love towards his elect people in adopting us into such a position of privilege. As the Apostle John says in his first epistle in chapter 3, Behold what manner of love the Father hath bestowed upon us, that we should be called the sons of God. Therefore the world knoweth us not, because it knew him not. It's a great privilege that we have been adopted into the family of God when others have not. By reason of this great privilege, we are enabled to cry, Abba, Father. With this adoption into the family of God, there also comes obligations of gratitude and obligations of filial obedience. And by the way, through this adoption, we too have been brought into the house of a great king, Christ, wherein we have become joint heirs together with him. So it's a great mercy then which God shows to us when he takes us from being children of wrath and he makes us children of God by faith. Finally, as Esther is settled as queen, Mordecai is not left wandering in the court. We see and have seen that he's found a place in the king's gate. So in her removal to the royal house, Mordecai himself finds that her elevation meant his elevation as well. Now this is to be expected because, taking up a theme that I advanced last time, when the king embraces a true religion as his queen, faithful prophets and teachers of God are going to find themselves in demand. And as is apparent later, should the king embrace a true religion for himself, well, then those faithful ministers will become a matter of his delight. Now, if observant Jews found reason to hope at the elevation of Esther to queen, why, they would be just bristling with expectation at the outcome that is, in fact, foreshadowed in what is revealed next in the verses before us today. Mordecai's quiet positioning gives every evidence of displaying a wisdom and a providence far beyond any of the circumscribed plans of men. So in verse 20, in those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door, were wroth and sought to lay hand on the king Ahasuerus. In those days, the author of Esther introduces another seemingly unrelated fact, and this is something that happens quite often in Esther. We're given little pieces of information that at first may not seem to have much bearing on the overall story or flow of the narrative, and yet each one reveals to us some small link in the great chain of providence that is being dragged through the book of Esther. It's a seemingly unrelated fact which happens to occur right around the time of the second gathering of the virgins. In those days. That is, in the days after the exaltation of Esther to the position of queen, in the days shortly after the royal feast, in the days as the king had settled back into his old habits and had revived at least at some degree an interest in the harem. Whatever had been his initial captivation with Esther, and now he's indicated he has a renewed interest in this harem. At this time, our narrator then takes us off the story of Esther and provides us with what, at first glance at least, might seem to be a total diversion. However, as I said, nothing in this book is being told to us without purpose. Furthermore, the author of the book of Esther cares little for the Persian Empire. It's not being told us because it's palace intrigue or political intrigue. Mordecai, who I believe is the one writing this book, he doesn't care about the fate of the Persian Empire, except as it pertains to the fulfilling of prophecy. He doesn't care much about these political intrigues, except as they pertain to the people of God. So with this change of scenery, what the reader is, or at least should be made aware of, is this. The reader should be made increasingly aware of the very deep complexity that there is in the working of divine providence. What this story should help us to understand is that God does not often work things out in a simple straight line. The deliverance of the Jews doesn't simply involve a straightforward linear progression. Instead, it is composed of a number of astonishing incidents that are astonishing more so in the fact that they, taken alone, appear to be relatively common occurrences or potentially common occurrences in this situation. But the fact is, by the end of this whole story of Esther, what we see is that all of these things are somehow intimately involved with this great miracle told us in the pages of this very small book. All of these things confirm that the great miracle of Esther is that there are no coincidences. Or that all coincidences are really displays of the hand of God. Now, the author obviously is aware of the inspiration under which he's penning the account, and so he beholds the whole fabric through a series of small lenses, and each one of these things forms the warp and the woof of the tapestry that is the story of Esther. In those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, they were reminded here how much things have already changed with the elevation of Esther. Very short order. Mordecai is now found seated among court advisors. He's come to hold some office, and we're not really totally sure what, but this is some kind of office pertaining to palace administration, and most certainly he's now seated among court advisors, perhaps, and almost certainly he's involved in issuing rulings of some degree or other. But that little parenthetical remark that we have in this verse is a reminder explaining to us exactly how it was that Mordecai came to be in what turns out to be the right place at the right time for what follows. And so we can see the unfolding of providence in the book of Esther looking backward and forward. We can see it's all interrelated. And providence is not just God sort of playing catch-up in history, but providence is actually a purposeful unfolding of a plan that can be traced backward and forward wherever you are. Now, the incident about to be related occurs, as it turns out, after he had begun his rise, and as appears hereafter, this incident is integral to Mordecai's increasing stature in the court of the king. Furthermore, you know, we know from this, it's his new function, actually, that that has placed him in a position where he's even able to become aware of the inner workings of the palace, particularly become aware of those who are charged with the security of the gate. Because after all, he and the others who are sitting to administer or rule or whatever they're doing, pass judgment, they're seated at the gate. And as we're going to see, that's where these people involved in this intrigue are. So this is bringing about another intersection of people designed to unfold the special providence of God toward his church. In those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains. Our attention is turned then to two of the king's chamberlains. Now, I've noted several times throughout these two chapters that the word translated chamberlain is really involves the idea that they're eunuchs. Now, it's through castration that men are turned into eunuchs. And the Persians were not the only ones who did this, but the Persians were certainly not hesitant in doing this either. They like to turn men into eunuchs for the royal palace. And they did so not only because it created a class of men that they could safely employ around the harem or other women in the palace. But overall, castration actually allowed these men to be better able to avoid any distraction from the opposite sex. The castrated men are not interested in the attention of women. They have no reason for it, and there's nothing in them inclining them to do it. So this allows them to have a more focused service. And it's actually quite valuable in guards and others who might otherwise be distracted or compromised by normal male impulses. And if you don't think this is a problem, you know, read some of the histories of intrigues in big events in world history where women insinuate themselves into the lives of men, and they turn out to be like Mata Hari, spies, and carry serious information to the detriment of a country. Because men naturally have impulses toward women, castration puts that to an end. Our text says there are actually two of these involved. Now, we know from other places in the Bible that in causes which are right and just, two is the smallest number that is needed for purposes of bearing witness. Conversely, in causes that are wrong and unjust, two is actually the smallest number needed to prove that you have a conspiracy. You can't have a conspiracy of one. And one person acting might reflect simply the act of a madman. If it's only one person, it could just be a quirk, right? It might just be something that you'll never be able to predict or know before there's an action. All of that changes, however, once you have two. Because once you have two, there has to have been some discussion. Once you have two, you pretty well know that there's been some planning. You have two, you know that they've entered into some kind of agreement. If you have two, at least two, you know that they've probably been engaged in mutual encouragement to a course of action that they've agreed upon. What's worse is that once you know you have two, well, the possibility is raised then that there might be three or four or more. Once you have two, it raises the very real possibility that there is a cancer in the body politic. Two, then, unlike one, two demands a thorough investigation. Two means you have to investigate to make sure that you're secure against any threat that they have conceived or any plot that they're going to hatch. In those days, while Mordecai sat at the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door. Now, as so many times in the book of Esther, Bigthan and Teresh, they're not names of persons. They're really actually names of Persian officials. Bigthan is a Persian, it's the root is a Persian word meaning a gift of God, and Teresh means severe or austere. What we can surmise from what is told us here is whatever their precise official standing was, it wasn't particularly high ranking. These were not the highest ranking people in the court. But we also know that at this time, they are deployed in the keeping of the doors of the gate, and as I said before, most likely the gate in the very area where Mordecai is sitting. Now, the ancient historian Herodotus, commenting on those who occupied this station, like Bigthan and Teresh, that in the Persian court, there were others who were like this. He says that they were such persons as no one could enter the fortress or the castle wherein the king resided without their approval. So they were the gatekeepers, literally. They enforced then a certain strictness or austerity such that if you were admitted to see the king, it certainly was like a gift of God. You had two of them. You had the yes and the no, the on and the off. You had two that had to find an agreement. They had to discuss it between one another. One who was inclined not to let you in, and the other who might have been more inclined to let you in. If they were both inclined to let you in, there'd be no gate to keep. It'd be an open door. On the other hand, if they were both disinclined to let you in, well, nobody would get to see the king. Now, the problem that arises because it's these two is that it's an especially serious problem. Because in the Persian court, in the palace or the fortress at Shushan, without loyal gatekeepers, there's no more security than if the walls around the palace had themselves been breached by an enemy. It's very serious. A conspiracy amongst the doorkeepers meant that the king was exposed to many dangers within and without. After all, these are the men as keepers of the inner court gate, they had easy access to the king. Now, there's an interesting side note, something we know from history. Xerxes I, Ahasuerus, eventually is going to be killed by conspirators within his very palace. We know from profane history that Artaban, the commander of the cavalry, conspired with Mithridates, who was a confidential chamberlain of the king. And that one night, while the king was asleep in his bedroom, the commander of the cavalry was let in by the chamberlain, and in the middle of the night, in the year 465 BC, he took a dagger and killed Ahasuerus, Xerxes. But as we're going to see in this case, at least, this time, he's going to escape those who are going to try to take his life. And the reason has a lot to do with the fact that, in this case, his escaping this assassination attempt is to the benefit of the church. In those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door, were wroth. The clause here implies that these two became very angry about something. On the other hand, it's just not clear in the text what the source of anger really was. Some of the rabbis suggest that they had been demoted by the advancement of Mordecai, and that they were upset about this. Now, whether this is actually the case, it certainly is often the case throughout life that when you see someone get promoted over you and you think that you have a better claim than the other one, that it will evoke jealousy, and sometimes that jealousy can become very bitter. What I think is actually a more interesting thing about this little clause here in the Hebrew is that the Hebrew word is actually not plural, it's singular. What it actually says is not they became angry, but he became angry. And so from this, the Jews note that this is not a natural anger, that this is rather an anger into which the Lord caused them to fall in order to bring about the continued rise of Mordecai, and all for the benefit of the congregation of Israel. Now, such was the anger that generated that it's very much like the anger that we find in Pharaoh, if you remember. The anger he had against his butler and his baker. And that anger actually did lead to the rise of Joseph. So I don't think that that's necessarily such a far-fetched idea. After all, none of this that's happening in the book is coincidental. Even the anger in the palace is moved by divine providence to bring forth the redemption of the righteous. So we read that these gatekeepers were wroth and sought to lay hand on the king Ahasuerus. Such was the degree of anger that we're told these two hatched a plot to assassinate the king. The Hebrew indicates that they sent forth the hand. It says they sought to lay hand. It really means, the Hebrew says they sent forth their hand toward him. And again, from this phraseology, there arose the notion that these conspirators didn't want to kill the king directly, but indirectly. So it's speculated either that they wished to poison him or perhaps use a snake, poison him by way of putting a snake into his wine cup. Now, while that may sound a little bit far-fetched at first thought. The likelihood is that they had decided upon some nefarious means other than the use of a simple weapon. Because as guards, they would have had some kind of weapon to use. But using that weapon that actually pertained to them as guards would have made it transparently obvious as to the identity of the killers once the deed had been done. So the idea that they have some other weapon to use, some other thing that obviously doesn't belong, that would help to explain at least how the plot ultimately is uncovered. You know, a knife or a dagger in their possession wouldn't give away the plot. But if they actually were found to have in their possession poison or a venomous snake, you know, that would have. So the idea that they have something else does make sense in the context. And I think in context helps make more explicable what occurs. The next verse. And the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it unto Esther the queen, and Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. The thing was known to Mordecai. Again, how this became known is not explicit. It's like most of the quiet workings of providence. We don't really see, very often we don't note providences when they occur. We sometimes perceive the providence or the hand of God more clearly after the fact. In fact, most of the time in these quieter events. As mentioned, Mordecai was often present, almost certainly, at the same gate where Bigthan and Teresh stood as gatekeepers. Now, the Jews, once more, they have a story about this, and their stories are always interesting. Sometimes they're actually instructive. They have a story about how this plot was exposed to Mordecai. They say that Mordecai was actually a member of the great Sanhedrin, and that it was required of those who were members of that body, the 70 who ruled over Israel, it was required that the Sanhedrin, that they actually knew the 70 languages of the nations, the 70 original nations. Now, I don't know if it meant that they had to know all 70 of the languages, or if each one of them had to know one of the languages. That seems more likely. It's supposed, then, that Bigthan and Teresh conspire before him, not knowing that, as providence would have it, he could speak the very language in which they were speaking. And so when he overheard them speaking, he actually overheard their planning and their plotting. Now, this notion was actually so ingrained in the thinking of the Jews that this becomes a matter, a point featured in later rabbinic debates over whether or not Jews should bother to teach their children other languages. Now, some argued from Mordecai that everyone should learn a foreign language because, after all, his facility in the language of Bigthan and Teresh helped to bring about the great miracle of the deliverance of the people of God. Others, on the other hand, pointed out that it wasn't needful for everyone to know. It was sufficient merely for a few such individuals to serve the whole community. And in that way, you wouldn't risk introducing the pollutions of the Gentiles to the children of the Jews. Whatever the case was here, the fact is that the two conspirators were certainly careless around Mordecai, and that carelessness itself was providential. Because Mordecai, we're told, came to know of their plot. And the implication is it was through natural means. He didn't have a vision. You know, God didn't speak to him. Little bird didn't tell him. You know, he somehow, by natural means, came to possess this knowledge. And then we're told that once it became known to him, thing was known to Mordecai, who told it unto Esther the queen. So once Mordecai has this, what does he do with it? He doesn't hesitate. This is serious business. These guys are going to try to kill the king. He immediately passes the information then on to Esther, so it could reach the attention of the king. Now, why does he pass it on to Esther? Well, I think there are several reasons. You know, because it's a conspiracy, he probably doesn't really know who else he could trust. Probably doesn't think there are a lot of options open that would be safe. What if you go to pass this information on to the king, and the person that you asked to convey, you find out, to your own detriment, that they too are part of this plot? If you try to expose the plot to someone who's involved, they're not going to allow that to happen. But he knows Esther. The very relation, of course, has been appointed by Providence. Several times before it actually is openly acknowledged in this book, we will see that Esther has come to this point for such a time as this. The story notes, in fact, here that Esther is no longer simply his adopted daughter or niece or whatever. Now, due to the outworking of the special providence of God toward his church, Esther's become queen. She's in a position to receive this information and do something about it. And he can trust her. He knows who she is. He knows what she is. She grew up in his home. He nurtured her and nourished her. On the other hand, she'd probably been the one who'd recommended Mordecai's advancement to the position he held at the court. And the Jews thought that she recommended him and probably pointed to the example of Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar and Joseph and Pharaoh and said, look, you know, every great heathen king has some Jew advisor. It's through this information that she could display both the wisdom of her counsel and ultimately the loyalty of both of them. And this completely foreshadows positioning the Jews as loyal subjects. And from the moment there's an inkling of a problem arising, there is this hope or promise held forth that these are loyal people. These people are on the side of the king. Now, how she manages to convey the information at this point without yet making known her own origin or that her kindred were Jews isn't clear. And we don't know that. We don't really know the pretext that she might have given for recommending Mordecai, because very clearly, as we're going to see in the next chapter, everybody knew that Mordecai was a Jew. There's no question as to who that Mordecai guy is and his lineage, his kindred. Now, we may ask the question at this point whether or not Mordecai should have even bothered to intervene to help save the life of a heathen king. A lot of people might wonder about that. But the Midrash notes at this point that Jacob blessed Pharaoh and Joseph interpreted the dream for the king and Daniel did for Nebuchadnezzar as well. I think what we have to keep in mind is what some of the covenanting fathers point out regarding people who occupied these places. They were brought to these places of power and trust without in any way compromising the faith or the principles of the true religion. We say that because they weren't required to swear any kind of loyalty oath. They weren't pledging themselves in any way to uphold some ungodly constitutions. They didn't have to sacrifice principle in order to think that they could do good to all men. We're never to do evil that good may come. It's not through these means that the saints overcome the world and bring deliverance to the people of God. It's not through voting. It's not through political activism. It's not entering into alliances with the ungodly. It's waiting patiently on the Lord, hearing the voice of God, knowing the times and the seasons, knowing what it is that you ought to do, and waiting for God to open the door. He told it unto Esther the queen, and Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. We're told next that when Esther told the king of the plot, she certified it in the name of Mordecai. In other words, what she did was she gave him credit for what had happened, or for what the information that had been conveyed. Now, in this little piece of information, we see that she's not stricken at all with vanity. Esther's not a woman consumed or concerned primarily with herself. You know, especially with the king's renewed interest in the harem, she might have used this information to find more favor in the eyes of her husband. She might have tried to parlay that piece of information into a better position in the palace. But she doesn't. Now, the Mishnah declares that Esther's faithfulness in crediting Mordecai is the thing that brought salvation to the congregation of Israel. And if you think about it, they're right. They're absolutely right. Everything, it turns out, in this book is going to hinge on the fact that she did give him the credit that was due. Now, interestingly, the Jews actually conclude that repeating something in someone else's name is that which will bring about the salvation of the world. It will bring salvation to the world. That's an interesting thought, isn't it? Where have we heard this before? How about John 12, verse 49? For I've not spoken of myself, but the Father which sent me, he gave me a commandment, what I should say and what I should speak. Now, those who are careful then to give credit where credit is due, the rabbis say they demonstrate a gratitude that carries over into all other aspects of life. And so such people will be easily persuaded to credit the Lord for their salvation and show gratitude for it when he brings it. For as they've noted, if one suffers and one cries to the Lord for help, and God should send salvation, how does a man react? You know, if a success in prayer makes him forget the Lord and turn from the God who saved him, they note it would have been better for him to continue to suffer than to be saved and to forget God. Those then who don't give credit in temporal matters are certainly not going to give credit to God for their salvation. How you behave toward people with whom you have constant contact in this life is actually a pretty good indicator of how you actually respond toward God now and will toward the Lord in eternity. Because you see, death doesn't change the nature of a man. As Solomon says, if the tree fall toward the south or toward the north, in the place where the tree falleth, there it shall be. The book of Esther, then, is designed to help us learn to recognize the many ways in which the Lord works daily, so that we can learn to give continual credit and express continual gratitude for the mercies of God toward us. In verse 23, and when the inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Therefore, they were both hanged on a tree, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. And when inquisition was made of the matter. Now, these words we can we can see the word of the queen was trusted by the king. With these words, we come to understand that Esther possesses a very different relationship with the king than Vashti had. Here's a picture in which Esther exerts influence, not through belligerence. She's certainly not nagging him, right? But she's influencing him through a very considered concern for the well-being of her husband. Her word, keep in mind, she's only recently become queen, but her word is already trusted because he knows that she is a woman of the highest integrity. She didn't come before him loud or boastful, perhaps like some of the other women. She certainly hadn't behaved herself in the contest in some vain or petty manner. In fact, in no way has she ever demonstrated that she was eager to advance her own name or her own cause. Never. And it's all of this taken together that recommends her words when she exposes this plot. And so the king takes this information, and we're told he moves very quickly. After all, if the doorkeepers are involved, there really isn't any time to waste. An investigation then was begun immediately, and the depth of the conspiracy was sought out. And we're told when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. So decisive was this investigation, it appears to have been over almost as soon as it began. They had good information from Mordecai. They had a good place to look, wherever Big Than and Teresh were standing. And so it was found out, and the culprits are immediately apprehended. The extent of the plot is discovered. And as I noted before, there might well have been some poison or some other thing out of the ordinary that confirmed the report received in Mordecai's name. Now, the Hebrew verb, the tense of the verb, it's in the nifal, it suggests actually that they were caught in the very act, which again suggests that they were up to something unusual or out of the ordinary. Perhaps that they had means in their possession which could only be explained as demonstrating the firm guilt of the parties involved. When inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Therefore, they were both hanged on a tree. And once the facts come to light, the guilt of the parties have been established, there's no appeal. Persian society, they're not locked up for life. As I mentioned on other occasions, we can thank the Quakers for giving us penitentiaries, places where it was believed that through the simple passage of time, men would come to see the error of their ways and be worthy of being restored to society. That notion, of course, denies the reality of original sin and the natural depravity of man. The purpose of punishment is not to make men repent, because without the grace of God, no one can repent. So even the heathen societies knew that imprisonment was only a means for holding someone until the fines were paid or the bodily punishments exacted. Now Herodotus tells us it was actually a customary mode of punishment among the Persians for death penalty cases to use crucifixion. It seems the use of a tree when exacting death shows that the heathen had some remnant sense from the light of nature that sin perhaps had entered into the world by means of a tree and death by sin. Furthermore, denying the malefactor a proper burial and letting his body hang until the birds of prey had picked the flesh from the bones was, because a lot of their superstitions, it was a punishment that they thought would follow him into the next life. When inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out, therefore, they were both hanged on a tree. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. The whole affair, we're told, the whole affair was written in the book of the matters of the days, or the book of the Chronicles. Every detail respecting the plot, its discovery, the fate of the conspirators, all of that it's all recorded in that book. And in this case, the record is so important, it's recorded in the very presence of the king himself. Now, again, Herodotus tells us that, for example, when the Persians went to war, they often had people following after them, historians writing down everything they did. So we actually know a fair amount of information about some of these ancient people because of this practice. The king wasn't always present when they were writing this down, but in this case, we're told it was such a momentous thing, the king himself wants to be present when they're writing it down. He wants to make sure it's recorded accurately. Included, of course, is going to be the part where Mordecai provides that key piece of information that saves the life of the king. And that's going to be there, as noted before, because of Esther's faithfulness in relating that little detail. One thing, however, was yet lacking in this story, although neither Esther nor Mordecai complain. And that is this: nothing yet had been done for the man who had exposed the wicked plot, Mordecai. But, as with all books that are kept, a reward is not going to be kept from him forever. Everything that's recorded and done, and everything that was for now left undone, all of this is done according to the hand of the Lord. So in concluding, I want to make a few observations. Consider first the plot against the king. Now, its wickedness is actually compounded by the fact that two from the very house of the king had hatched this conspiracy. And these two were undoubtedly very much in his debt for the many favors that fell to them simply by virtue of the fact that they lived in the closest proximity to the king. These are people who got the crumbs that fell from the king's table in a world where nobody had crumbs. In a world where the king had everything and everybody else had nothing, these men had a little bit of something. Now, their anger is both sinful, because it's against one in whom they themselves acknowledge an authority to command and demand their obedience. But the anger is also inordinate. It breaks out into a homicidal malice far exceeding any offense either taken or given. We don't even know what the offense was. It evidently is something so minor, it doesn't even warrant being mentioned. It's petty. That's bad enough when you're troubled by thoughts of rebellion against lawful authorities in your life. That's bad enough. But when these thoughts break out into speaking, and when you turn to others and you try to incite a conspiracy, when two or more enter into an agreement to do wickedly against their acknowledged superior, they're challenging the authority which God has set in the earth. They're making war with God. So consider, secondly, that this conspiracy is detected. They don't get away with it. You know, evil purposes are very often defeated very early. But every evil, nefarious purpose will come to light. Beware, we're told, your sins shall find you out. It might even seem improbable in this case to those who were involved in that plot of theirs, that their plot was discovered not by someone of their own nation. Their plot was discovered by one whom they might, with all probability, have concluded would lack any natural sympathy toward the one who is subjugating him and his people. And if the problem is in all of this, in all sin, in the heat and passion of sinning, we very seldom stop to think about the purposes of God and the designs of providence that are arrayed against us when we do sin against him. Fact is, detection of sin very often arises from sources we could never have anticipated or even suspected to exist. Again and again, obscure means often provide deliverance from unknown quarters. We see it throughout the scriptures. Now consider thirdly, this conspiracy is actually punished. You know, conspiracies to do evil are conducted against the designs of God, and they're going to be punished with a vengeance that shall be swift, severe, and sure. As the psalmist says in Psalm 76:10, surely the wrath of man shall praise thee, the remainder of wrath shalt thou restrain. It's notable that the mode of punishment used by the Persians was particularly cruel, crucifixion. Very horrible, if you know anything about it at all. However, if we understand that given the elevation of Esther to be queen with this particular king to bring about the salvation of the people of God, should their design, Bigthan and Teresh, should their design have been allowed to succeed, Israel would have been destroyed by their enemies. And probably many of them would themselves have been crucified. And so the punishment that's inflicted on Bigthan and Teresh is actually only one that would have been intended for the Jews had they succeeded. In fact, we see this later in the book. Consider fourthly, this conspiracy is placed in the record. It's put there for a reference for a later date. In the event, there are those to be condemned and there are those to be praised. The memory of the latter shall be held in esteem, whilst the memory of the former are exposed so that they might rot. You know, faithful records encourage loyalty and warn conspirators. And of course, as we know very well, history alone can detect who's actually been faithful and who's actually been unfaithful. We need history. Finally, it's worth meditating upon a simple fact held out in these verses. Mordecai, for saving the life of the king, is written in the book of the king for good. Think of that. The recording of this one good deed will become the basis of the deliverance, the miracle that will be wrought for the people of God by Mordecai through Esther. This one incident recorded in the book of the Chronicles of the King will be the incident that will redound to the honor and praise of Mordecai forever. Now, if this is the value of being written into the book of an earthly king, how much more are those deeds recorded in the book kept by which God shall judge the world? Again, the Midrash notes that the greater the owner of the book, the greater the reward of being inscribed in that book. It's funny that the Jews should say this, because if that's the case, how much greater is it to be written in the Lamb's Book of Life, wherein we receive the reward, not for that which we have done, but for that which he has done in putting to death sin in his own flesh. So with that thought, it's no wonder the scriptures say, "Blessed are the dead who die in the Lord." Amen.